Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's Sunday, November 11th. I'm Margaret Brennan, and this is Face the Nation. With a split decision in the midterm election for control of the House and Senate, and after igniting controversy, after controversy at home, President Trump is honoring the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. But at a somber gathering today in Paris, the chill among his fellow world leaders seemed to match the weather, with a notable exception. We'll talk to two newsmakers who won on Tuesday, including a familiar rival of the president. With Democrats retaking control of the House, leader Nancy Pelosi hopes to regain her job as speaker.
God bless Texas!
And Texas Republican Ted Cruz will also join us. What are his thoughts on the president's new immigration orders?
Bring us snipers, gotta go!
And chaos in the Sunshine State. Plus, as momentum grows for new acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker to recuse himself from overseeing the Mueller probe, we'll talk with South Carolina's Lindsey Graham. Plenty of politics and news all ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. It has been a difficult week in America. Following record voter turnout in the midterm elections, some races are still not decided, and the partisan political divide has ripped even wider. A mass shooting killed 12 in California. The suspect is a veteran who may have been suffering from PTSD. Then wildfires exploded in the state. One in Northern California is already the most destructive in California's history. President Trump sparked outrage with tweets blaming California forest management for the disaster and threatening to cut off funding. Today, the president is in Paris, attending a ceremony honoring the 100th anniversary of the armistice ending World War I. We begin there with CBS News White House correspondent Weijia Zhang, who filed this report.
A solemn Sunday in Paris. As President Trump marked the day World War I ended a century ago.
November 11, 1918.
He stood alongside dozens of world leaders at the Arc de Triomphe, where the tomb of the unknown soldier symbolizes the ultimate sacrifice. French President Emmanuel Macron seemed to take a veiled swipe at the president's America First agenda.
Le nationalisme.
Nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism by saying, aren't us first? Who cares about the others? We erase what a nation holds dearest, what gives it life, what makes it grace, and what is essential, its moral values.
Mr. Trump did not appear amused. While in France, President Trump also recognized the need to maintain strong alliances, but he often receives criticism for warming up to adversaries, including Russian President Vladimir Putin. The White House says President Trump and President Putin will likely meet on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Argentina later this month. Today, the president is heading back to Washington. Margaret?
It's Weijia Zhang. Thank you. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham joins us this morning from Clemson. Senator, welcome to Face the Nation. I want to get
Thank you.
The French president seemed to be saying the liberal world order is being undermined by forces, nationalist forces, that seem to be represented to many by President Trump. Do you agree with him?
No, I think he's got a political problem at home. Macron does, and probably picking a fight with Trump is good politics. I like the idea of President Trump pushing NATO to pay more. Getting out of the intermediate ballistic missile treaty with Russia made sense to me because Russia is cheating and the treaty doesn't cover China and North Korea. I think the main friction is getting out of the Iran deal, which I thought was bad for America and really bad for the world. So Republican presidents always have a hard time in Europe. I'm not really worried about this at all.
Well, Senator, let's move to what's happening here at home. You're seeing some of the worst fires in California history raging nearly dozen dead. Yet the president is taking an aggressive, combative stance here, even threatening to cut off funding. What's achieved by doing things like this?
Well, number one, my heart goes out to the people who have lost their homes. I think there have been about 25 people killed. These are historically large wildfires in California. But we do have a forest management problem all over the country we need to address. But, you know, California will receive the money they need. But going forward, we need to look at some of the underlying causes of these fires. And it's just not California. We need to look at better forest management in terms of federal lands all over the country.
So you agree with the sentiment, but perhaps not the tone is what I hear you saying there.
This has been a debate for a while about underbrush clearing in federally owned lands, but now it's not time to talk about cutting off money. With all due respect, we're going to help our friends in California. They need help.
I want to ask you, since you sit and are an important voice on the Judiciary Committee, about what's happening now with the search for the new Attorney General now that Jeff Sessions has been forced out. You've said you're going to meet with the acting attorney general this week.
Right.
Are you going to ask him to recuse himself? And is Matthew Whitaker's appointment to this role constitutional?
Good question. I talked with Matt yesterday. I'm going to meet with him next week when we get our schedules aligned here. I think he was appropriately appointed legally. I don't think he has to recuse himself. I am confident the Mueller investigation will be allowed to come to a good, solid conclusion that there will be no political influence put on Mr. Mueller by Mr. Whitaker to do anything other than Mr. Mueller's job. I'm confident that Mr. Mueller will be allowed to do his job without interference.
I ask you that question because, as you know, there have been a number of public statements made by Whitaker, including saying there's no criminal obstruction of justice charge to be had against President Trump. That seems prejudicial to many. He's referred to special counsel as the Mueller lynch mob. What about these comments suggest to you that he's going to be impartial?
Well, you don't recuse somebody because they have opinions different than the people they're overseeing. Trust me, there's politics abounds when it comes to the Mueller investigation that Trump's guilty, and no matter what Mueller finds. But the bottom line here is that Mr. Mueller will be allowed to do his job without political interference by Mr. Whitaker. Mr. Whitaker, I think, is legally qualified and otherwise qualified to oversee this investigation until a new attorney general will be appointed, and I think that will happen early next year.
Early next year. What's your first question for that nominee?
Depends on what the lay of the land is. If Mueller is still not finished with his investigation, are you going to allow him to do his job? But a lot of questions about how the Department of Justice works.
The president issued an order this week and says he's going to issue another executive order having to do with immigration.
Right.
Does he have the authority to bypass Congress in doing these things?
You know, the 14th Amendment, birthright citizenship, that's got to get to the court. Maybe the executive order is the way to start that discussion. But when it comes to changing asylum laws, saying that somebody here illegally cannot apply for asylum, I don't know if you can do that by executive order, but I support that policy. Right now, people are marching on our border. If they cross illegally, then they ask for asylum. Asylum shouldn't be a magnet for illegal immigration, so I support the policy change. I'm not so sure you can do it by executive order, but we'll see.
Well, the ACLU suggests that that's actually contravening Congress and established law.
I might want to get another opinion than the ACLU, but the point is that I do believe asylum laws are being abused. They've become magnets for illegal immigration. People cross the border illegally, then apply for asylum. That's not the way asylum's set up to work. I support the policy change. Congress probably should do it, but I'm open-minded to the executive order. I just don't know the answer, really.
You've been speaking a fair amount about what's going on in Florida and the recount there. The Florida Department of Elections has presented no evidence whatsoever of criminal activity there. The president has been sort of fanning the flame, some would say, of conspiracy here, saying Democrats are trying to steal it. Don't you think in some ways that this undermines election integrity when you're actually trying to uphold it?
I think what undermines election integrity is Broward County can't get their act together over multiple elections. If the Florida law enforcement officials see no fraud, I will accept that. But they are in violation of the law, Broward County. They're supposed to report results within 30 minutes of the polls closing. They've counted almost 80,000 votes days after the polls closed. So the problem is not with President Trump's rhetoric. The problem is with the incompetence and the mischief in Broward County.
All right. Senator Graham, thank you very much. Lots to get through today. On Friday, we sat down with House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, who was working to round up the votes among Democrats to become speaker once again. We began our discussion with the Democrats' call for the new acting attorney general to recuse himself from overseeing the Mueller probe after the president asked Attorney General Jeff Sessions to step aside last week. Do you think under Whitaker that the integrity of this investigation is in peril?
Yes, I do. First of all, I think that he should recuse himself for any review of the investigation because of statements he has made already in the public domain about the fact that this investigation should not...
You don't have confidence in him as America's top enforcement officer.
No, I don't. And don't just take it from me. There's bipartisan editorializing about this, that he should never have been appointed and that... It does violence to the Constitution and the vision of our founders to appoint such a person in such a manner to be the chief legal officer in our country. And that's bipartisan.
There are questions about what will happen when Bob Mueller wraps up his investigation, the report and the conclusions he comes to, and whether they will ever see the light of day, because we don't know if they're going to be shared with Congress. In a Democrat-controlled House, with subpoena power, would you force that?
Well, we don't know what he will decide and what will be made public, but we do want the truth.
The public has a right to know.
The public has a right to know, and no one is above the law in terms of our having access to that information.
So you don't think it would require a subpoena to the DOJ to release it?
Well, let us hope not. But the beauty of our Constitution is the system of checks and balances, and in doing so, to have oversight responsibility to be a check. So in our oversight responsibilities, we would want that information.
What are the bounds of that oversight? Because, you know, one of the concerns you hear is Democrats are just going to issue subpoena after subpoena and make the president's life legally more difficult. Is there a limitation to that you see?
Well, we are responsible. We are not scattershot. We are not doing any investigation for a political purpose, but to seek the truth. So I think a word that you could describe about how Democrats will go forward in this regard is we will be very strategic.
No investigation for a political purpose, you say.
That's right.
A number of Republicans would say, come on. There's always a political upside or downside to moving forward with some of these investigations.
Well, if the Republicans would say that, they're just projecting their own attitude toward investigations, which was very political. We are coming to do something that is very important for our country, a more open Congress with accountability to the public, with a seeking bipartisanship where we can find it, stand our ground where we can't.
The president has been saying that there's election fraud in Florida. What do you think is happening in Broward County? Is this election fraud, and is there a role that Congress needs to play in upgrading election infrastructure?
Well, yes to the second part, but let's go to the first part first. My experience with the president is any time he charges somebody with something, he's just projecting what he might have done himself. We are not engaged.
Election fraud?
Well, obstruction, suppression of the vote. Those kinds of issues are I think, wrong and not in honor of our sacred right to vote. So no, there is no election fraud. What there is an honest count of the vote.
On immigration, would you try to block any attempt to fund the border wall?
Let's just enlarge that issue into what we need to do as a country. We certainly have to protect our borders, and Democrats know that, and we have always worked to do that.
So you'd be open to supporting this?
Protecting our border, and we have done that. And there are many ways to protect the border before tens of billions of dollars building a wall where technology and personnel and the rest could possibly do the job. But whatever it is has to be tied to comprehensive immigration reform. What this administration has done is undermining our values, taking babies out of the arms of their moms. As you're a new mom, you understand that bonding very well. As me, as my mother of five, grandmother of nine, understand that bonding very well. Let's take the baby out of the arms of their moms. Let's separate families. Shameful. And what the president just did in the last day on the executive order flies in the face of even what the evangelicals, who are his big supporters, have said. The evangelicals have said the United States Refugee Resettlement Program is the crown jewel of America's humanitarianism. And what the president did does not recognize what the law of the land is and in terms of refugees.
There's a lot more of our interview with House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi ahead, including her plans for fixing the Affordable Care Act and the record number of women in the next Congress. That's coming up in our next half hour. We turn now to another of Tuesday's winners, Texas Republican Ted Cruz, a key member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he joins us from his home in Houston. Senator, welcome to Face the Nation.
Thank you, Margaret. Good morning, and welcome back yourself. Congratulations on your new son.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. A little bit of history here. You were part of President Bush's legal team back in 2000 during the Florida recount. We are looking once again at questions about what is happening and a recount there. What is going on? Is this political conspiracy like the president suggests, or is this just incompetence?
Well, listen, I think there is certainly reason to be concerned. Florida's history on recounts has not been great. You've got each of the counties there that have different commissioners. I spoke yesterday with my colleague Marco Rubio, who's following what's happening there closely and is deeply concerned that what might be playing out is an attempt to steal the election. I hope that's not it. I think everyone needs to be vigilant. Every vote needs to be counted. But at the same time, we can't allow people to be stealing votes, and we need to be on guard against that.
A bit of both? You say it could be getting stolen or it could just be incompetence?
It could almost always be a bit of both, of incompetence and the potential for malfeasance. But any time you have a recount, you have an invitation for people to violate the law and try to advance their partisans. In 2000, in Bush versus Gore, on election night, George W. Bush had about a 3,000 vote lead, and there ended up being a total of four recounts in Florida over and over and over again. And over the course of those four recounts, Bush's lead dropped from about 3,000 votes all the way down to 537 votes. And the mantra of the Democrats is they wanted to keep counting and counting and counting the same votes over and over again until they managed to drop the votes to the other side. I think that suggests, if you're recounting, the numbers ought to stay the same or roughly the same. And if they're moving consistently in one direction, it suggests you may not have a fair and level playing field in terms of those counting.
I want to ask you, since you're on the Judiciary Committee, about what happened this week. Jeff Sessions being forced out. Now there's an acting attorney general overseeing the Russia probe. Do you believe that the special counsel's investigation is now in peril and needs to be protected?
Well, I don't think anyone was surprised to see Jeff Sessions move on. Jeff is a good man, an honorable man. He's someone who's been a friend a long time. But it was clear that his relationship and the president's relationship were not working, that there was no longer trust and confidence there. And that's not a long-term sustainable situation to have an attorney general and a president in direct and open conflict the way they were. I think Jeff did a number of very good things at DOJ, including on immigration, including on religious liberty. So I'm grateful for those efforts. But I think it will be good to see new leadership come into the Department of Justice. Now, Mr. Whitaker, as I understand it, has been appointed just in an acting position, and the White House has announced they intend to nominate a new attorney general. I expect that to happen quickly. And when it does, the Senate will take up the advise and consent role. And I'm on the Senate Judiciary Committee, so whoever the nominee is, I look forward to hearing from that individual their background, their record, their qualifications, and their vision for what the Department of Justice should be doing.
Should there be legislation to protect the special counsel?
No, I don't believe there should. We had a bill come through the Judiciary Committee that tried to make it impossible for a special counsel to be removed. I believe that legislation was unconstitutional, that it was inconsistent with Article 2 of the Constitution.
You were very critical of the Obama administration for taking action via executive fiat, as you said. You called it dangerous. This week, President Trump on immigration has issued orders bypassing Congress to restrict how migrants crossing the border illegally can claim asylum. Are you okay with that now?
Well, I'm still studying the specific immigration order, but I'll tell you, look, here's my view on executive
Congress.
Let me explain my view on executive orders, whether from Trump or Obama, George W. Bush, or anybody else, which is there is a legitimate role for an executive order, and that is governing how the executive branch operates, how under Article 2 of the Constitution, the president, the executive branch is charged with taking due care that the laws are faithfully executed. And an executive order is perfectly appropriate to direct the executive branch, this is the manner in which we shall execute the law. What Obama did repeatedly that was so lawless is his executive orders didn't do that. Instead, they said, here is the federal law passed by Congress, signed by the president, that we will defy, that we will ignore. And that the president can't do. And so that's the question on any executive order is it directing how the executive will behave, or is it flying in defiance to laws passed by Congress? If it's the latter, it's unconstitutional.
So I don't hear a clear answer on whether you think this asylum change is okay. Do you think via executive order it is appropriate for the president to end birthright citizenship, again, bypassing Congress?
Well, Margaret, as I said, on the executive order on immigration, I have not studied that order yet. It just came out this week. You know, I have to admit, I was kind of busy. We had an election a couple of days ago, and that. So I have not yet reviewed the executive order, and I try on legal decisions. My career has been being a constitutional litigator, so I don't reach constitutional opinions lightly. If the order defies the laws of Congress, then yes, it's unconstitutional. If the order constrains and directs how the executive will implement the law, then it's not. Now, my understanding is this executive order does things directing resources to the border. Those resources are clearly within the purview of an executive order for the president.
And birthright citizenship executive order, that's coming.
The president is charged under executive law, under federal law, with securing the border. And if the executive order is in furtherance of the statute, then it's not only allowable, it's appropriate and good. I mean, this so-called migrant caravan of over 10,000 people marching north, declaring their intention to cross the border illegally. I can tell you, I told the president just recently when he and I spoke, I said, Mr. President, under no circumstances should we let them cross. We should use whatever tools are available, whether it is Border Patrol, whether it is National Guard, whether it is the military that the president has called up. But we shouldn't allow 10,000 people to blatantly and deliberately violate the law. There is a right way to come to this country, and that's following the law, waiting in line, and following the rules.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing your views on birthright citizenship and those asylum decisions. We've got to leave it here, Senator. We want to continue our conversation with House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi. In the next Congress, there will be at least 100 women in the House. That's a record. We asked Leader Pelosi about the new freshman class.
We get 23 women, got us to the majority, and then we have many men, some of people of color among those men, it's to take us to bigger heights. I want to salute the quality of our candidates who took their message, their why they wanted to be in Congress, what they cared about and what they knew about that, and how they connected in a very personal way with their constituents. We own the ground because people were inspired by them, and the outside groups did so much door to door, telling stories about health care and why that was important in this election, and so many other personal stories. So personal stories won the day. Health care was the big issue. I'm here to protect that health care. In terms of the diversity, we used to be over 50% women, people of color, and LGBTQ. Now we're over 60%. And that's a beautiful thing, that diversity for our country. The additional people who will change the face of security in our country, and of our not only our national security, but our national economy. People say, oh, you're going to have more women, so you'll have more emphasis on childcare. Well, we already have that, and we'll do more. But the point is that every issue is a woman's issue.
One of the issues that Democrats campaigned on was protection of the existing health care law.
Yes.
Republicans and the president have talked about pre-existing conditions and something they want to actually protect. So what does that actually mean in practical sense? Do you think that there is any room for reform of ACA, of Obamacare?
Well, you have two different questions. One is the pre-existing condition as a not being a barrier to getting coverage is part of the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. The Republicans have tried to disrupt that. They did it in their Trump Care or I Don't Care bill that he had, and it was defeated. They now are going, they didn't succeed in the Congress, so now they're going to the courts. Any large number of Republican attorneys general throughout the country have brought suit against the pre-existing condition benefit, and instead of protecting the law of the land, the president has sided with those attorneys general who want to eliminate that benefit. They misrepresented during the campaign where they were on this. They have another chance now with us in the majority to join us into removing all doubt that the pre-existing medical condition is the law of benefit, is the law of the land.
Does this change anything for you in terms of your sense of needing to stay here?
But
needing to stay as Speaker.
Well, I'm staying as Speaker to protect the Affordable Care Act. That's my main issue, because I think that's, again, about the health and financial health of the America's families. And if Hillary had won, I could go home. Nobody from California ever gets Potomac fever. You may know that. But
that's still your North Star right now, though.
What?
The protection of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, that. I mean, I hope we will have a woman president very soon. But that's not the fact that we almost had one. Would have been motivation for me to say there's a woman at the table. It's very important. You cannot have the four leaders of Congress, the President of the United States, these five people, and not have the voice of women, especially since women were the majority of the voters, the workers in campaigns, and now part of this glorious victory. But these women bring each their individual excellence to the Congress, and we're very proud of it. When I came to Congress, there were 12 Democratic women. I said, we have to change this. Now we'll have close to 90, and that's a major accomplishment for the American people, but also for the Congress.
How do you respond to those who say there still needs to be more diversity in leadership, either age-wise, because you look at the other two leaders alongside you and 78 years old?
Well, that's
do you need to have some of these new progressives who've come
we
in
have
them. Younger?
We have had leadership. Them in the leadership along the way, and that more will be in now that we have more positions. When you have the majority, you have more positions to put people in leadership. But our leadership doesn't just extend to the caucus chair, vice chair, all that. It's about the leadership of our committees. And in our leadership of our committees, we have beautiful diversity, women, people of color, LGBTQ. It's a sight to behold to see all of that diversity, all of that talent leading the way. And some of the people here like being a chair more than they'd rather be chair of the caucus. They would be the chair of the Armed Services Committee or chair of the Financial Services Committee.
And that's how you would resolve these questions.
Well, people have to run. When I first ran, people said, who said she could run? Nobody smoothed a path for me. I've tried to smooth the path for others. But you have to run. You have to want to do it.
Policy-wise, what does that mean?
Policy-wise, that means that the face of national security in our country will be very different and very diverse. We have many women coming in with experience in national security. We have many women here moving up in the ranks on national security. But I want to make sure that everybody has a security credential, whether it's in all the different committees of jurisdiction in that regard. It also means that women will be taking the lead on our economy.
When you said you're a transitional figure, is that what you're transitioning towards, handing off to these women?
Well, I've always considered myself a transitional figure. I am on a mission, and that mission was to honor what we did with the Affordable Care Act. It stands with Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid as pillars of economic as well as health security for the American people. When we had the opportunity to do it, we fought hard, and we won. And now we have to protect it not just as a legislative matter, but as what it means in the lives of the American people. And so I think we're on a good path to protect it. It was the central issue in this campaign. And so many of the outside groups told their stories, walked their precincts, won their votes for us to preserve and protect the Affordable Care Act and improve it.
Now for some analysis on a week that defies words here in Washington, we welcome our political panel. Dan Balls is the chief correspondent at The Washington Post. Rachel Bade covers Capitol Hill for Politico, and she's also a CNN political analyst. Mark Landler is a White House correspondent for The New York Times. And Ed O'Keefe is a political correspondent here at CBS News. Ed, let's start off with you. We had these midterm races Tuesday.
Right.
Do we have final results from some of these other races that are outstanding?
Well, first of all, welcome back. We're glad
Thanks.
To have you back in the building.
Congrats to you. You're new dad.
That's well, yes. But the answer to your question is no. There are still several unresolved races. We should start with the big one in Florida, of course, the Senate race, where Rick Scott maintains a 50% to 49.9% lead. But you can see there just about as many people that show up in a traffic jam in Miami separate these two from first and second place. Florida governor's race, obviously, still very tight. The Arizona Senate race, what was notable there, of course, is that the Democrat Kyrsten Sinema has pulled into the lead. You talk to Republicans in Arizona, they quietly concede Sinema will probably hold on and win. And the Georgia governor's race, the goal of Democrat Stacey Abrams is to see if Brian Kemp gets below 50%, but in the ongoing recounts, he hasn't done that, so he may ultimately hold on there. A handful of House races have not yet been called. CBS and the other networks do it slightly differently than the Associated Press, so we're a little more cautious in when that those calls are made. And as the speaker mentioned, or speaker-to-be, we presume, more than 30 seats will be picked up by Democrats, so she'll grow the size of her caucus. And notably, too, that we're going to have more than 100 women in the House, which I think really transforms the governing dynamic up on Capitol Hill and will make for a really interesting few years.
So that's where we are in terms of the numbers. But in terms of the opinions, some have very different views on where these races are, Dan. I mean, the president has weighed in, and you heard Senator Lindsey Graham also cast some doubt on what's happening in Florida and the integrity of that election there.
Yeah, the president weighed in and basically accused Democrats of trying to steal both the elections in Florida and in Arizona without any evidence of theft or fraud. There are problems in some of the counties in Florida, which is unfortunately not a new situation in Florida. And those of us who covered the 2000 recount remember all of the problems down there, and some of those have not been solved. But there is counting often goes slowly, and it takes sometimes days and weeks in some states to actually get a final vote on these elections. And there's a process underway. It will be closely watched at this point. The opportunity for fraud will probably be quite minimal at this point, given all of the attention that's going on. But the president, by doing that, undermines faith in the basic process of our democracy. And it would be better, obviously, if people in positions of power let the process play out. There are a lot of people who think that the Republicans likely will hold on to both of those tight races in Florida. They are ahead narrowly, but they may have enough votes to be able to hold on. People should simply wait.
Rachel, biggest Democrat gain in the House since 1974, and more women than we have ever seen winning elected office for this new Congress.
Right.
Given this environment, does that change much?
We'll have to see. I mean, I think that Republicans know that they have bled in the suburbs. Republican leadership, they were encouraging the president before the election to sort of tone down a lot of this heated rhetoric. He did not, and they paid a price for it. The question here is, do Republicans learn from it going forward? And the president, in terms of looking at 2020, I think he thinks his own reelection is better if he continues that rhetoric, which is a different sort of election than House Republicans would need to retake the House. In terms of Republican or in terms of women coming to Washington, I can tell you that on Capitol Hill, there's already discussions about changing the campus to make sure they can accommodate all these women and make sure that it's a friendly work environment for mothers. There's new baby changing tables and bathrooms for lawmakers, and there's talk about nursing stations around the Capitol. But again, policy changes. You saw Pelosi talk about health care, making that a key issue next year, and I think that would be smart for them, especially because Republicans sort of tried to deflect a lot of attacks on health care by saying we do care about pre-existing conditions when, in fact, they tried to repeal Obamacare.
Sliding in the suburbs, I think, is how Leader McConnell put it in terms of a problem for the GOP. But Mark, for the president, as Rachel just said, does this necessarily cause a change in tone, a change in behavior for him? Because certainly after Tuesday, he seemed as combative as ever.
If anything, more combative. I mean, he came out and made this rather hapless effort to claim victory. And then when it became clear over the ensuing days that really he had taken a stinging setback in the House, you saw his mood sort of deteriorate through the week. And as Rachel said, and Dan, he went after the electoral process in Florida. He went after the press. He went after the rule of law, in a sense, in putting Matt Whitaker into a job in the Justice Department on an acting basis that many people have profound problems with. So you really saw him shift to an aggressive stance on almost across the board. There are issues where the president has said he could work with a Democratic House, infrastructure being one, potentially immigration. But the big question that I would have is the president going to be capable of compartmentalizing potentially productive work on the legislative side with an unrelenting round of investigations that he now faces in a Democrat-controlled House? I think that's emotionally going to be very difficult for him. And he already made clear in the past week that if the Democrats really investigate him aggressively, he will respond in a warlike way. He will try to investigate them. So it's sort of difficult from where we sit, based on watching his demeanor over the past 3 days, to see how he shifts to a more cooperative, collaborative stance. It feels like we're in for more and more partisan combat.
And what should we expect in terms of cabinet member departures? Jeff Sessions, that was telegraphed for months.
I think the big one to watch out for is Jim Mattis, the defense secretary. You may recall the interview where the president said, well, Jim Mattis is basically a Democrat. So the question is, does Jim Mattis really take this as a cue to either leave on his own steam, or will the president now put pressure on him? John Kelly, the chief of staff, is another person to watch. The president, or John Kelly, rather, has said that he's been asked to stay through 2020. We'll see whether that really happens. There's evidence his wings have already been clipped within the White House. But I think the really consequential one is Mattis. And that's one that would have really a profound effect in foreign perceptions of the United States and in the foreign policy and the national security of this administration for its last 2 years of the first term.
Ed, how does that environment that we just heard described shape up for the president? I mean, you've had already a number of the Democrats who expect to be in leadership positions in the new Congress say they're readying subpoenas.
Right. And I think, actually, while we watch the dynamics among the president and his staff, one of the more interesting subplots in Washington over the next few months, at least, certainly, will be bringing in that new wave of Democrats, many of whom were elected on the idea that they want to come here and serve as a check on the president. A lot of younger people who were inspired to run because of him and their opposition to him, and how they run into a leadership class led by, at least for now, Nancy Pelosi, an older committee chairman and chairwomen, who will want to do a lot of this work, but aren't necessarily going to want to go as far as a lot of base Democratic voters across the country want them to go. Jerry Nadler, the House Judiciary Committee chairman, reiterated again this morning, as has Speaker presumed Pelosi, that they will only go into impeachment if the evidence is overwhelming and if there is bipartisan support for doing so. That is a high bar.
Yes.
Both of those. And I think that could create some early conflict among Democrats. But you'll see them go after things like what was going on at the EPA when Scott Pruitt was there. Why does the Secret Service have to pay money at Trump Tower and Mar-a-Lago and all these other places? And try to go after the president's tax returns. And each one of those has the potential to really upset him.
Right. Still, Republican-controlled Senate as a backstop for that. We want to discuss some explosive exchanges this week between the president and members of the White House press corps.
That's enough. Pardon me, ma'am. Excuse me. That's enough.
I'm not responding. I'm responding to. Excuse me. I'm not responding to you. I'm talking to this gentleman. Will you please sit down? Excuse me. Would you please sit down? Please go ahead.
On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
That's such a racist
there
question.
Some people.
Do you want them to rein in Robert Mueller?
What a stupid question that is. What a stupid question. But I watch you a lot. You ask a lot of stupid questions.
I was the president there speaking about Abby Phillips of CNN, who is a very smart journalist. You also heard Jim Acosta of CNN, April Ryan of American Urban Radio Networks, Yamiche Alcindor of PBS, all getting real fire from the president. Mark, what's happening here? I mean, the president always seems to be combative with the press, but to many, this seems a new level of aggression.
Yeah, I think that the midterm election and the setback he suffered there has maybe changed his psychological frame and not for the better. We were used to this kind of a vexed relationship. We've had it with him from the start. But what you saw this past week was really of a very different order, stripping the credential of the CNN correspondent Jim Acosta. That's something that no recent president in memory has tried to do. And the attacks, the verbal attacks on April Ryan, Abby Phillip, and Yamiche Alcindor are particularly, I think, problematic because the three of them are African-American women. For him to say to Yamiche, a former colleague of mine, that asking him a very valid question about his inflammatory rhetoric is somehow a racist question, I think really is at some level beyond the pale. Likewise with Abby, she asked an absolutely valid question about the future of the Mueller investigation under a new leadership at the Department of Justice. And April Ryan, who, by the way, wasn't even present for the session where he simply went after her, mm-hmm. presumably because she had tried to ask him a question at his press conference earlier in the week. These are all professional women doing their jobs the right way. And for him to single them out and be so ad hominem, I think is a new level. For those of us in the press corps that have been used to this, I think we're all a little bit stunned by what we saw this past week.
And Dan, there is a lot to be said in parsing this, and that the media shouldn't be talking about itself as much as we have been in terms of this aggressive line with the president. But tell us why this matters in the broader political sense. You did have some journalist organizations come out and even criticize the phrasing of questions from fellow journalists. Is there a policing of the Fourth Estate that needs to be done, or is this in any way acceptable, this kind of language?
Well, there's always self-reflection that needs to be done by those of us in the press. I mean, I think we all have to constantly think about what's the best way to do our job, particularly in a very difficult environment. And I think every news organization and every reporter who covers stories like this does ask those questions. But that begs the issue of what the president has done, not just this week. And I agree with mm-hmm. Mark. This was another, you know, several levers up in his attacks on the press. But he has done it consistently, and it is strategic on his part, because it is designed to undermine the validity of a free press. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we know that it inflames his base supporters. I mean, I think everybody around this table gets emails from people who are very loyal to Donald mm-hmm. Trump, who in fact believe that we take it as our job to try to undermine him. That is not the case. We hold people in power accountable, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. We can be tough on presidents, and we often are, and presidents don't particularly like that. But most presidents, or all previous presidents, have reacted differently than President Trump has, and I think that's the issue. And as Mark said, particularly the attacks on three African-American female correspondents, mm-hmm. all of whom are professional in the way they approach their job, is another aspect of this that is even different from simply attacks on the press.
Well, and he's taken on two Latino correspondents as well, Cecilia Vega, the previous one, and Jim Acosta. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some of us, that isn't coincidence. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of what is so troubling. But, you know, one thing we do need to point out with this president, like him or hate him,
yep.
the press corps sees him and gets to question him more
right.
often than we did George W. Bush and Barack
That's
Obama.
That's a very good and point. Yeah, very good point.
Rachel, just button us up here quickly. I mean, for those who say we're being overly sensitive, that there's nothing racist in what the president did, there was a lot of strains, these nationalist tones, so to speak, that were rewarded on the campaign trail, were they not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, race right now is like is one of those topics that Republicans, it's hurting them right now when they hear and they're following the president. They're trying to distance themselves from the president. But, you know, this keeps coming back and hurting them on the campaign trail. I mean, I'm thought of Steve King mm-hmm. and some of the rhetoric that has come out of, you know, his mouth. And it sort of divided the Republican leadership about whether or not to back him or just not say anything. And we actually saw one Republican leader, the NRCC chairman, Steve Stivers, come out and say, listen, this kind of rhetoric is not acceptable, and we have to stand up against it. Notably, no other House Republican leaders did that.
And he was resilient.
Yeah, and he was reelected.
Well, we have so much to digest from this week, I think all of us, by the end of it. That's it for us today. Thank you for watching. It's great to be back with you. And we'd like to thank all of the veterans who have served and protected this nation and those who are still on active duty. We honor you today and every day. Until next week, for Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi and Republican senators Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Allison Hawley. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow the show and CBS News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m., 3 p.m., and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.